wonderful guest, Ronald Alexander. Ronald, welcome to Solutions Radio.
Oh, thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Oh, we're glad that you could join us. I know that you've just finished a book signing, and you're right in the thick of a book tour of this fabulous book, Wise Mind, Open Mind. But now that you're brand new to Solutions Radio, and we'd like to invite you to the family. We have a very relaxed and loving atmosphere here. We have some really wonderful listeners. I see them all in the chat room. Hello, family. Everyone is just so insightful and so evolved, and they just soak up this great information that you're bringing forth. But since you're going to welcome yourself to our family, please share a bit about your background. Let us know what brought forth this passion for healing and helping others to evolve.
Well, it all really started kind of with a funny story. I was transferring from the University of Massachusetts in Boston in my junior year, where at that point in my development, I was just a 20-year-old business major, first in my class in business administration, nice Irish Catholic from 10 children in an Irish Catholic family in Boston. And I had vaguely heard, you know, some Moody Blues albums in my teenage years, but I had no reference to anything, as we would say, in the spiritual. I was still going to a Catholic church. And I transferred in the first week that I got into Amherst. I started having anxiety and panic attacks because all my friends were in Boston, and I didn't even know what anxiety was. So I went to the mental health services, and there was a young intake MSW counselor, and she said to me, well, I could give you an appointment with an older man who's a psychiatrist who will give you medication for your anxiety, or I could give you an appointment with a young psychologist whose name was Dr. Ken Poey at the time, who just got back from a year traveling through Southeast Asia and India, and he could counsel you and teach you meditation. So what would you like, medication or meditation? And that really, I said, well, you know, I don't know anything about medication, but that kind of sounds kind of scary. And I don't know anything about meditation, but I was always an adventurer because I started reading existential philosophy when I was an adolescent because I was playing in a music group in Boston, so I go into Harvard Square every weekend. And so I was really fascinated with what this meditation was. So I went, and after two or three sessions, he sent me to a Buddhist mentor who was teaching Buddhism both at Smith College and at the University of Massachusetts, the late Dr. Teresina Havens, who was actually a Quaker but had spent her life as a professor at Yale and at Smith College and then at UMass Amherst, where I met her. And I started attending weekly classes, and then she suggested that there was some yogi or swami from India who was coming to the student union on Friday night. And I got there kind of late, and there was probably 250 students all laying in the Shavasana pose, chanting Om. And the lights were out, and I just went right there. I mean, it was as if I had come home. I had experienced like a profound welcoming by the Holy Other. And it was like, this is my tribe. I have been adrift for these first 20 years, but now I'm at home. I'm with my people.
Okay, so that was just natural for you to get right into that.
Yes.
Wow.
It was like coming home, all the Sanskrit mantras, the yoga, that I started minoring in Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist studies at Smith College, and then studying psychology. I switched out of my business administration major to the disappointment of all of the professors at the university who thought I would be a young MBA prodigy to be, and started reading and drinking and eating everything that I could on mysticism, Buddhism, yoga psychology, altered states of consciousness, hypnosis, parapsychology. And at the same time, I immersed myself in several courses at a very unique college in Amherst that is called Hampshire College. And it was just in its very, very beginning. I think it was its second year. And there were a lot of creative courses on the physics of consciousness, creativity in consciousness, art, music, and film. And so I kind of blended my interest in creativity and music and film along with psychology, and then this entirely new field of altered states of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's right up our alley here at Solutions and also at Occult Science and Illuminations. Well, you know,
yes,
in light of your book, powerful treatment program there, and you speak a great deal about wise mind, open mind. In fact, that's the title of the book, and it draws heavily on the Buddhist practice of mindfulness. Can you explain what mindful meditation is, and what would be the difference in just a regular meditation, and how would this be beneficial in helping somebody get through a crisis or a change in life?
The easiest and simplest way to explain mindfulness is from the perspective of that although its origin and root comes from Buddhism, because it was the very, very, very first meditational approach among many that the Buddha began to teach and lecture about in the deer park in Sarnath, which is outside of Bodh Gaya, India, which is in the ancient old kingdom of Ayodhya. And he began to give his very first lecture after he had experienced his realization and his sense of lucid clarity of the nature of being and the nature of the unenlightened mind and the enlightened mind. And in that very first lecture, he spoke and taught about, which I write a lot in the book, that the most direct and simplest path, free of any religious belief, any connection to even a guru or a teacher, is, he said, that if you practice mindfulness, which is the attention to the breath as well as the cultivation of what is called a witnessing mind. And the witnessing mind is that part of our consciousness that observes, it notices, it watches, it looks at, and then in the very core of mindfulness practice, it sees deeply into that of which is occurring outside of ourself. And then more importantly, mindfulness is a way of witnessing and looking and seeing deeply into the nature of what is arising, what's existing, and then what is falling away into liberation or spacious freedom. And so mindfulness is a very direct and laser-like method of seeing through the egoic mind. In the Buddha's realization, he discovered after 30 or 40 years of wandering and traveling, ever since he'd left his very Brahmin and very prince-like home in India, lived for many, many years in the forest and studied with yogis and gurus and sadhus and nagababas, that mindfulness, after all of these very esoteric practices, that there was this one very simple and direct way of looking at all mind moments. And he discovered that mind moments could be divided between wholesome, meaning positive, neutral, and then unwholesome or painful and afflictive. And that's where in the Tao Te Ching, which is an adaptation really of the very first treatise on mindfulness, is that all phenomena is divided between the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows in life. And for any of us, at any given moment, we can be in the part of the wheel. And I write in the book a lot about the mandala of life, in the mandala of how we experience joy in one moment as one spoke in the wheel, and then the wheel of life or the wheel on the wagon of self starts to turn, and then we can be in a profound trauma or tragedy or heartbreak or some sort of physical or life-threatening disease or illness. And that mindfulness helps us. If you think of a yogi on a surfboard and standing in tree pose with like a little cartoon caption coming out of the top of his head that says, "You can't stop the waves, but you can learn to ride them." And yeah. So in Wise Mind, Open Mind, I write extensively about that we really can't stop any pain or suffering or any trauma or tragedy that is going to just arise. But what we can do is we can learn to ride through the wave of it with applying the practice of mindfulness. And one of the articulations of mindfulness that I've contributed now to the field through the book is I developed an idea, and I call it mind strength. And that mindfulness practice and mindfulness meditation will lead you into a way of cultivating, if you wish, if your muscles, the muscles of the mind and the muscles of consciousness are weak or they're out of shape, in the same way that if you physically haven't worked out for a long time and you go to a gym and you start to slowly work at building up in your muscles of your body and building strength and stamina, that as you practice mindfulness, over time, you will build what I call mind strength. And mind strength is a way of utilizing a laser-like witnessing to view everything that arises, exists, and falls away. And then over time, that mind strength will help you to live in a more compassionate, in a more loving, in a more I-thou, I-other centric way, rather than to be so self-absorbed and self-centered in yourself. And most importantly, that mindfulness will help you to develop compassion and also allow you and enable you to become less reactive and more empowered and more thoughtful and reflective before you respond to other beings in the world.
Uh-huh. And, you know, something that I really, it's very, very interesting. I do really enjoy the application here in your book where you're looking at the unwholesome self-judgment. And you have a whole grid, a list of so-called negative self-judgments. And then you have the wholesome aspect, which is how you kind of flip it and turn it around and look at the gift that's in it. And then you give us a beautiful affirmation there. I really enjoy that, the one, envy. If you could share that with us, it's quite powerful, and it's very, looks like it's the sister or the first cousin to shadow work.
Yes, it is very similar to shadow work. And the flipping process comes really from what is called in Buddhism the turnaround of the positive antidote. So, for example, let's say that people who are listening to the show right now, and I suggest that they enter into a mindfulness state and they imagine the quality of envy, and they'll just allow that to come into their mind and to focus on who or what they're envious about, because envious in its unwholesome aspect causes a lot of pain, but including myself, we're all envious of something, and at some times we're even more envious of other people than other times, and envy can be a real trap. So what I always in the work, what you do in turning around a positive antidote is from the unwholesome mind state of envy, you identify, well, what's the wholesome aspect? And the wholesome aspect is I expect more of myself. And then the affirmation of what is called in the Buddhist antidote remedy is you turn that around and you create not only the positive mind state in the form of the belief. So, for example, the positive embodiment of envy would be I admire others and I appreciate everybody's uniqueness and I aspire to greatness. I have vast creativity inside of myself. I value myself. I appreciate the gifts that the divine has given to me. And then as I suggest that people go through repeating those as if they were positive affirmations, the Buddhist piece that's very unique is it then threads the mind state to the body. And then I suggest that as you go through each of those positive embodiments, such as I admire others and appreciate everyone's uniqueness, I ask people to then find the embodied feeling or sensation that accompanies that. So, for example, I value myself. Well, you can say you value yourself, and if you really don't value yourself or you're in a state of disavowal or self-hatred or self-criticism, which many of us as beings are in sometimes, you know, we're at the bottom of the wheel, or as I say in the book, we're under the wheel of self, is if you find the positive sensation and you locate that in the body somewhere, now you've created a resource so that you have a two-step process so that that affirmation over time will then become threaded into a positive sensation in the physical body. So that, let's say, in oftentimes when I'm teaching or I'm working with a client one-on-one, I'll say, well, take your hand and put your hand on your third eye for the mind state, and then take your other hand, and usually I suggest the left hand because it's the more feminine and receptive, or the yin part of the body, and place it somewhere on the body where you imagine you want to store that positive, wholesome, embodied quality of the mind state. And let's say they put it on their heart or their heart chakra or down on their navel or their belly. Now that they can receive from that, because now it's as if they're downloading it and they're storing it as a positive embodied resource, as a healing resource in the physical body. And what's beautiful about this that I came up with in the book is that sometimes people are not able to utilize just the affirmation, that the affirmation won't penetrate the quality of negativity or the quality of afflictiveness in the mind. But the key is if they access the positive embodiment in the form of a physical feeling and a physical sensation in their body, they can bypass the negative mind state, go right to, say, the heart chakra, or to the stomach where the positive sensation is, and they can access that. And so then the statement, I value myself, or I am unique and I appreciate the uniqueness of others, well, that's a feeling. And when you can access a feeling, it can then turn around the negative mind state.
Uh-huh. Very, very powerful. And, you know, I work as a hypnotherapist in my day job. So a lot of this really applies, but memory, looks like memory plays an important role in the aggravating and the relieving of those emotions. Can you talk a bit about the memory's negative effects and how we can enhance the positive ones?
Sure. And as you know, as a hypnotherapist, memory, when we understand the mind, there's a lot of various models of the mind. But one of the many different models of the mind that I embrace and I write about is that the mind really is a series, it's a series or a complexity of records.
Mm-hmm.
And memory is a multiplicity through states of consciousness and stages of human development, starting from birth. However, though, if you're familiar, which you might, the work of Dr. Stanislav Grof says that memory can actually begin in the pre.
I'm sorry, Ron. We're losing you.
You are?
It seems like you're going in and out just a bit.
Okay. Let me turn the volume up. Is that better?
Okay. Yeah, you seem fine.
Yes,
now.
We can hear you much more clearly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Somehow, maybe the volume got turned down. So, Stanislav Grof, who was a very famous consciousness researcher who, as a young man, I had the good fortune to work with at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Baltimore, Maryland. And he found that through utilizing various altered states of consciousness, that people oftentimes had memories prior to the actual experience of birth. And
yeah.
They had memories in utero. And, of course, if you embrace the notion of past lives as an idea, as a concept, as a possibility, that when you do hypnosis, oftentimes past lives and past prior cellular memories will just emerge, spontaneously. What I always find very unique around the subject of memory is that I don't even have to suggest to someone who, for example, has been extremely traumatized, and let's say they were either sexually abused or they were physically abused in some way or tortured as a child, or oftentimes when if I work with somebody who was in one of the wars in Serbia or Bosnia, and I'm working in Europe and doing some hypnosis, is I'll find that a woman will come in her early 30s and have a lot of various physiological symptoms, but will have no memory of what the trauma was. And then I'll suggest that we go into a hypnotic state, starting, of course, with a mindfulness meditation. And then with the use of hypnosis, when you create enough safety, comfort, and support, that memory will naturally just emerge, almost as if you were downloading files from somewhere onto your desktop, on the desktop of the conscious mind. So memory is a very unique aspect of our consciousness. And what's fascinating about memory is memory can be both confabulated, which is that sometimes we can remember things that actually are different than what really occurred.
Exactly.
Right. For
yeah.
example, we were, in the book, I write a story about that in first grade, I'd come back from children's hospital because I have an operation the last week of August to remove some thickness underneath my tongue that made me really talk funny. And so the teacher, Mrs. White, being well-meaning, suggested that I come to the front of the class and I tell all of my schoolmates about what the experience was like spending a week in the hospital. And I still had stitches under my tongue, so I talked even funnier. And what I remember was, it was like one of those scenes out of the movie Animal House where they're behind a cage, a band, and everybody's throwing bottles and jeering and leering at them. I remember the entire class of like 32 kids all laughing and humiliating me. And the real life experience, because I had the opportunity while I was writing the book to look up some of my school chums from Boston, is they said there was probably about 3, maybe 5 people that were taunting
right.
you.
Out of all 30, so.
But my memory, when I was writing the book, it was 32. They were all picking on me and calling me names and, you know, making the same humiliating gesture that I was making while I was talking. So memory, on the one hand, it can be distorted. But what's also fascinating is that when you get into hypnotic work that involves age regression, is that you can discover that memory that is real, but it's been repressed, and memory that comes from the cellular aspect of our physical body. Case in point, a 50-year-old woman comes to me about 2 years ago, and she's referred by her gynecologist. And she's referred because she was sitting in the gynecologist's office, and she's 50 years old, and she opens up the the magazine section of the New York Times, and there's an article on false memory and recovered memories. And she reads the article, and there's a discussion of sexual abuse from a parent and a child, and it was the famous case of Holly Ramona in California, which I won't take up our listeners' time to go into that with any kind of depth. But Holly Ramona was a young girl at UC Irvine who was having an eating disorder, and she walked into the counseling center, and she said, I'm having trouble holding food down. And the social worker there started to do a series of hypnotic sessions with her, and they discovered that she had been sexually abused. And she called her mother up, and she immediately got corroboration from what she was remembering, and it started a whole domain of law around trauma memory treatment and law. And so then my patient came in, and I had just read the Holly Ramona case, and she told me that she read this section in the New York Times and was reading about the Ramona case, and then all of a sudden she had this incredible, overwhelming feeling in her physical body where, like, all of her cells in her body around her pelvis and her stomach were on fire. And then she started panicking. And that's all that she could remember. So over the course of 6 to 8 weeks of hypnotic regression sessions, she started to have physiological feelings and sensations about the trauma and the abuse first. And then in one session in my office, she actually opened her eyes in the hypnosis, and she said out loud, "I can see the wallpaper on the hotel where I was sexually abused as a child by my father." And in those days, like in the 40s and 50s, they used to wallpaper ceilings in hotels with a kind of real funky kind of wallpaper. Yeah, and then in her physical body, she had a recovery of several of the memories in the form of physical pain. And so memory is a very fascinating aspect of our conscious awareness in terms of what we can remember and what we can forget.
I see. Now, I was watching one of your videos on meditation, Ron, and it was a really good video, I should say, on how to meditate, you know, and you know, most people who teach meditation, they advise you to concentrate like an inch or two below your navel. But in your particular meditation, you advise to concentrate on the third eye. Now, people have always, I've always heard people say that they have trouble meditating, you know, turning off the noise in their heads, if you will. And, you know, they don't feel that they're succeeding at their meditation, so they give up. You know, so now, what would your advice be for them? You know, and how could they best utilize? Because I once had that same problem. It took some practice. But now, for those who are out there who would love to begin meditation, what would be your advice for them?
Well, the most important thing is I would advise people to know that there's no one way to meditate, just like there's no one automobile that's designed for one person. That's why we have so many different variations of automobiles. So that if you think of meditation, that you can learn to focus your awareness at your third eye point. You can focus your awareness at the tip of your nostrils. You can focus the breath, as you said, a couple of inches below your navel point. Is that people, particularly who have really overactive and hyperactive minds, who have the most difficulty sitting quiet, some of those folks might want to embrace more of a meditation in action, more of what we call like a Taoist approach, taking a nice brisk walk out in nature, and or a nice long bicycle ride where they're paying attention to the breath rising and the breath falling away, or the mind opening and the mind clearing, like repeating something like that, where it's a meditation in movement. And then if they're more Buddhist inclined, we actually have forms of walking meditation where you walk very slowly and you say to yourself, as your right foot is lifting and then it's moving, then it's shifting and then it's placing, and then you say your left foot now is lifting, it's shifting, it's moving, and it's placing. So you can walk very briskly in the one hand for a meditation in action, or you could learn to walk very, very slowly. And that helps people who are very hyper, very type A, who have a lot of agitation in their mind, a lot of distraction. Then, short of people who are really, really painfully distracted and suggesting that they sit on a meditation cushion or sit in a chair, most of the time I suggest that people learn to meditate from three different vantage points. One is that they find a place to focus their eyes, so that they roll their eyes up to the, either the third eye point, or look down and close their eyes at the tip of the nostrils, or to focus 3 inches below their navel. The second approach is that as they're focused in one of those three points of attention, is to pay attention to the quality of their breathing and to be mindfully aware of breathing in long, slow, and deep, and breathing out long, slow, and deep. And breath can either be in meditation in through the nose and out through the nose, or it can be in through the nose, and if you're feeling particularly emotional or you're very tired, you want to breathe out through the mouth so that you can exhalate and eliminate any negativity, any toxicity, any qualities of imbalance. Then the third kind of meditation that I suggest for some people, because just watching their breath, it for some people is very effective and very laser-like and very helpful in attuning, but for other people they really need what we call a focus of attention. And what I think works best, whether you use a word like the word one, mm-hmm. O-N-E, which would be more of a kind of Western approach, they breathe in and they repeat the word one, or oneness, and then they breathe out and they let go and they repeat the word oneness. If you're prone to utilizing mantra meditation, and let's just say from a Hindu or transcendental meditation approach, is you could repeat it, the word Om on the in-breath and Om on the out-breath, or you could take one of the many hundreds, if not thousands, of mantras from Sanskrit, and you could repeat the word Ra on the in-breath, and then long, slow, and deep Ma on the out-breath. And Ra in Sanskrit means the sun energy. So you could even imagine that as you're breathing in, mentally repeating in Ra, that you're infusing your body and you're infusing your mind, and your chest is a wonderfully bright yellow sun. And then as you're breathing out Ma, which Ma means the mother, and it's the feminine energy, and you're letting go, and you're releasing, and you're comforting the self as you breathe out Ma. And that's a transcendental and also it's a Vedic mantra. TM comes from the Vedas. And that's another very helpful and useful way to meditate, so that those people listening who, if they're just following their breath in and they're following their breath out, they find that not quite comforting enough, then they might want to experiment with either the word one or experiment with a Sanskrit mantra like Ra and Ma or with Om. And then, of course, sometimes there's people who are less interested in embracing something that is outside of their own religious or spiritual practice. And so, for example, in Christian contemplative meditation, whenever I work with nuns or priests or Christian monasteries, I'll oftentimes suggest that they do something that's called centering prayer meditation. And, for example, they can just say words that come from the Christian tradition and they can visualize, for example, the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And so they have the visualization of the Sacred Heart of Jesus or the Blessed Divine Holy Mother. And as they breathe in, they can visualize either the Blessed Mother at the heart chakra or the Sacred Heart of Jesus at the heart chakra. And as they're breathing in, they repeat the word opening. And as they breathe out, they're repeating the word feeling into. So they can feel into the quality of the Blessed Mother. Or they can feel into the quality of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And you could go. I could go on for an hour going through the different religious approaches, whether it's Jewish and Kabbalah and Islamic, for example, Assalamu Alaikum or Allah Akbar. There are ways that you can teach people to meditate in their own religious and spiritual tradition.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Powerful.
So that
that
it doesn't
feels
have
really,
to be.
Yeah. I was just going to say that just by listening to you explain that, I feel meditative already. I've already gone into
Oh, yes.
Most definitely.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I would love to touch on those five hindrances that you speak of in the book. I love the way that they're beautifully explained there.
Well, the hindrances, not the hidden payoffs. So
no.
the hindrances to the mind.
Yes, those five hindrances. Those basically their attitudes,
well,
their stances that get in the way.
Yeah, the in most Buddhist meditational practices, we talk about what's called monkey mind, and monkey mind is what I was talking about earlier, where there's always qualities of distractions, and there's things that the mind wants to be doing other than meditating and following the breath or repeating the mantra. And the first number one hindrance that I write about in the book is called wanting mind.
Yes.
And wanting mind has the qualities of grasping or clinging. And I write in the book about, there's a saying that I learned from the silent yogi Haridas Baba, who is the main teacher of Ashtanga Yoga at the Mount Madonna Center up in Watsonville, California, about a half hour south of Santa Cruz. And he took a vow when I met him in 1973, and he took the vow in 1969 as a very young man around the age of 26 or 27 to never speak again. And to only make little sounds like when he is trying to have someone do something. And he writes on a little chalkboard. And I asked him about wanting mind, and he said, the best way to understand clinging and grasping is that whatever you run after, whatever you chase, will run away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you run away from, will chase after you. In the one hand, we want to grasp and cling especially to anything that's pleasurable, that's ecstatic or blissful, joyful, loving, successful. We want to hold on to it. And the problem with wanting mind as a hindrance is that when you start to squeeze something, so for example, if you take a lemon and you squeeze it in your hand and you raise your arm straight out in front of you, well, at first, in the first minute, it feels really kind of comfortable and your hand wraps around the lemon and your arm's out straight and you're stretching and it feels good. But if we pick up with you about 30 minutes in, when my yoga teacher in India said to me, don't move and hold that lemon for the next 3 hours, you develop a lot of pain. And And so wanting mind activates, like lots of longing, wishing. You start yearning or pining for things. Wanting mind as a hindrance causes hunger. You start thinking about all the different things that you want to eat or you crave for, whether it be of food, sexual desires. A lot of addictions and addictive behaviors come from what we call core cravings in the Vedas, qualities of greed, emptiness. And there's a hindrance in wanting mind where there's a constant sense of wanting more. And you see that hindrance in very successful people, especially not only in people who don't have enough and really are hungry, but there's the hindrance of very successful people when you get everything that you could ever have dreamed of. I experienced this at age 34 in one of my very early stages of samadhi. I was in India, and I was traveling, and I was very euphoric and very blissful. And I went out one night by the Ganges River, and I was watching the sunset and the fog set in. And I had at this point a very successful private practice. I had more money than I could ever have dreamed. I had, you know, brand new Saab. I had love in my life. And then out of nowhere came this, like, desire. Like, well, I want more. And so that's the hindrance that you have to deal with. And I think every one of us at every step of this game of spiritual consciousness and evolution, we all have to deal with this hindrance of wanting mind, because it's always going to emerge. No matter where you are, you have to come to this place that I created a meditation in the book called Contentment and Satisfaction. That's right, satisfaction meditation. Yeah. You know, it was kind of I did a riff, because I used to play the Stone song in the band as an adolescent, like, I can't get no satisfaction.
Yeah.
And so many of us, as satisfied as we think we ought to be, there's still that craving that goes off, and that comparing and jealousy or envy or desiring for more. And what I suggest is that the best meditation for wanting mind is satisfaction meditation, where you start to meditate on all of the things that the divine or God or the force or spirit has given you as blessings, all of the things that you have as gifts that you were either born with or you learned over time with hard work to cultivate. I oftentimes teach my students that it's really important to bless your food and to be thankful for whatever food that you have. And having been a monk and traveled in India and been in the monasteries, that you oftentimes are sent out early in the morning as a meditation to deal with wanting mind just with an empty bowl. And you really don't know if the people in the village are going to put any food in it. And you're hungry. And you really, really want to eat. And sometimes your bowl is filled overflowing. And some mornings you come back and there's nothing in it. And that's part of the teaching. is to sit with the empty bowl and to sit with the emptiness, to learn to convert the emptiness into satisfaction. And in the chapter on core creativity, I write about that. When we can welcome immersion into that of which is empty, eventually, as if we were crossing through the fog of a river to get to the other side, there's always inside of ourselves an incredible spaciousness and fullness. And that's the golden pool of our inner creativity and our inner divinity. And no matter how hungry or no matter how wanting we really are, when we immerse ourselves and we can touch into that golden pool of spirit, we can fill ourselves and we can bathe ourselves and we can wash away the pain and the suffering as we go deeply down into that vast well of being, and we can drink from the waters of the well of being. And as we drink from the waters of well of being, we'll find that there's a core gold of creativity in all of us. And as long as we can access that core gold of creativity, wanting mind will eventually quiet itself. It'll pass away. And you can discover that you could actually go through not only one day without any food, but you could go through 2 days without any food, as long as you can drink from your own internal well of being. You'll never be thirsty and never really be hungry and never really be wanting.
Wow, that's absolutely gorgeous. That is, you know, that's literally, it's all within you. Everything you need is within yourself, not outside of yourself.
And you just have to trust and enter into a state of core level faith that it really is all inside.
Yeah.
And there's so much inside that the divine provides us with. There's a wonderful quote that St. John, the Christian mystic, spoke of, and he said that I see God through the same eye that God sees me.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can embrace that, that the divine is abundant, and it always was, it always is, and in some form it always will be. And our job, I think, as spiritual searchers and seekers is to really let go and surrender and to trust deeply into the state of what is called core level faith. And it starts with being able to access the divine inside and to see the divine as the divine sees me. A poet somewhere along the road, I don't know if it was Leonard Cohen or one of the beat poets in Greenwich Village, but they once said that the deeper that you immerse into your own mud of self, the more that you will start to see that the lotus of the heart in yourself will flower.
Mm-hmm. So don't try to avoid getting dirty.
No. and that's where the shadow work comes in.
Yeah.
You know, in India, no matter where I traveled, whether it was in the Ganges River, which was pretty dirty, or I visited these lotus gardens, is that the lotus flower, beautiful and white and pristine as it is, it grows in a mud pond. And so there it is. It's right there. There's the polarity of it all. The white and the dark. The dark giving birth to the light. And then the light returning to the dark. Because at night, the lotus flower closes up and it goes back down into the mud pond. And so our shadow and the shadow self is where our gold is.
Yeah.
That we don't need to really work at purifying. what we need to do is to get a little more dirty, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think Christina Aguilera actually wrote a song called Dirty, and I don't think she's just talking about dirty in the nasty element. I think she's also poetically speaking about you got to get down, you got to get dirty, and that's getting into the mud of ourselves.
Right.
We'll definitely be discussing that on Occult Science Radio.
Okay. All right.
We have 5 minutes left. I hope we have time. I would just love to touch on those three states of consciousness, the wise mind, the big mind, and the open mind.
Well, wise mind, I discovered while I was meditating in Sri Lanka at a Buddhist monastery. High up in the mountains in an old British hill station, and it was a former British tea plantation that now is a Buddhist mindfulness meditation monastery. And I'd been meditating for many, many days with just the simple instruction to follow my in-breath and follow my out-breath, and to visualize a complete and perfect circle. And at times I would go into the master and tell him I was having a lot of trouble, and I was thinking about, you know, when I could, you know, get down to the local village and get some chocolate cake and cappuccino. And and out of nowhere, I just started efforting less. And I experienced the visualization of the in-breath and the out-breath come together in a perfect circle. And then I just was dropped right into wise mind. And wise mind was that state of consciousness where I was experiencing the wisdom of the ages and the wisdom of the stages as always having been, and they were ever present right now, and they would ever present always be. And then from there, in the next few minutes, whether it was minutes or hours, because my experience was really beyond time and space at that point, I had the experience of big mind. And I'd always read about big mind in my early Zen training, but I never experienced it. So it was more of a kind of an intellectual idea. And big mind was when I experienced my ego. In my egoic mind of Ron Alexander as the meditator, meditating in order to awaken, completely dropped away, and there was no egoic mind. There was vast, oceanic, spacious stillness, and it was ever-present, and it was pristine, spacious awareness. And it was the bigness of having no little mind, no little self, no little Ron.
Mm-hmm.
And then that emerged into, like, as if the cosmos hadn't given me enough in those two gifts, but there was gift number three. And then it was, now we're going to let you take a look at open mind.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, from wise mind, I threaded into big mind, and as if you could take a beautiful golden cord, if you were weaving the cosmic creativity of tapestry, it weaved me into open mind. And what I heard there was when you're in the opening, all you need but do is open, and you're already inside of the opening. So just breathe, open the heart. And then I had this experience where it was as if I was listening to the cosmic music or the Akashic music of all times and all ages, and I had this incredible feeling in my heart where I was tasting what, like all the great painters and all the great writers and all the great poets and all the great sculptures had experienced, what they channeled in And that was the experience of open mind, that the mind became open and free, and then the core creativity that flows through the universe, and it flows through every single one of us, like a trumpet, it began to blare open for me. And
beautiful.
That was the immersion into open mind, where I realized that creativity was something that we all possess, but the distinction is whether our mind is open or our mind is closed.
Oh, that's so beautiful, and I what a wonderful way to end the show. I thank you so much, Ron, for doing
it. It has been a pleasure.
Oh, you're very welcome, and
definitely.
I just would love to remind everyone that the book is called Wise Mind, Open Mind, and you can get it on Amazon.com or at any bookseller nation and worldwide, and that my website is www.ronaldalexander.com, and it's been a joy to be with you.
It is most definitely.
Likewise, and I will be contacting you, Ron.
All the best.
Definitely.
Many blessings.
Have you on again. Blessings. Thank
Good night.
You.
Good
and
night.
I thank you all for joining us, everyone who's listening remotely, everyone who's joined us in the chat room. We thank you so much, and I'm just closing out the show with Lennon Honor's Visions of Hope. Here, this is Tamara Westwood and Curtis Davis signing off.
Peace.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can seem intense. Like breakup R&B intense.
I thought you said you loved the sweater that I got you. If you didn't, you could have told me.
Geico makes it easy. Just go to Geico.com anytime to update or check your policy without all the extra drama.
I even had a gift.
impression of a drill instructor directing a musical.
Tailhut! Get those tap heels in line and let me see those jazz hands! Are you bundling your home and auto insurance through Progressive? Can you hear me through those sequins?
Bundle your home and auto through Progressive and save.
Left, 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 and step ball change.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates. Home insurance provided and serviced by other select insurers.